Hey everyone, and welcome to Have Disability, We'll Travel, a podcast from the Accessible Travel Forum. This podcast takes us around the world so we can talk to people in the accessible travel industry, influencers, nonprofits, travel companies, and people like you and me who don't let our disabilities get in the way of a great vacation. My name is Josh, and I'm glad you're along for the ride. So grab your passports and let's get going. In this episode, we talk with Martin Sibley. If you are at all involved in the accessible travel community, you likely already know Martin personally or by name. We discuss Martin's work, including being the co-founder of Disability Horizons and Accommable, as well as his book, Everything is Possible. Without further ado, here is Martin. Hi, Martin. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Josh. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, I'm glad to have you. You're such a big name in the accessible travel community, so it's very exciting to have you here. I'm a bit nervous, actually.
We'll go slow.
Okay, sounds good. Well, first of all, where is home for you, Martin? You're from the UK, right?
Home is England, and specifically a town near to Cambridge, so the old university town of Cambridge.
Okay. So does that have some unique accessibility issues, being such an old town?
Yeah, there are definitely some challenges, but I mean, to be fair, they have looked after it quite well. It's got better and better. And in fact, on Thursday, I'm going to be working with the local council on showcasing the good accessible places that are now available. So it's on the up accessibility-wise.
Oh, that's great. Good to hear. Okay, so now, since this is a podcast about accessible travel, you have to give your creds and tell us exactly why you know about accessible travel. So can you tell us a little bit about your disability?
Yeah, sure. So my disability is spinal muscular atrophy, which whenever I deliver training and say, has anyone heard of SMA? And very few people have. And then when I say, has anyone heard of muscular dystrophy? Everyone has. And so it's kind of under the family, the umbrella of muscular dystrophy. So that basically means that, yeah, I'm in a wheelchair. I wouldn't say 24/7 because contrary to popular belief of the general public, as you know, Josh, we do get out of our wheelchairs from time to time and sleep in a normal bed. But I'm in the wheelchair all day long and have full-time care support and all of that kind of world. I guess it doesn't affect my kind of health that much or my energy that much. I have to be a bit more careful in the winter, which is one of the reasons I love traveling to get away from the gloomy, cold English winter at times. So I guess that's probably the best way of describing my disability anyway.
Okay, so since a young age then you've been using a wheelchair?
Yeah, well, it's genetic, so I've had the disability since day one, and then I've never walked, and I had the first wheelchair when I was like 3, and I'm now 35, so I've been driving for 32 years now.
And how many accidents have you had?
Too many,
okay. All right, so now moving on to the travel bit, you can have a little bit of chance to brag here, and maybe you can tell us, you've probably been to too many places to list, but some of the best places you've visited around the world?
Yep, so the big kind of challenge trip I did independently. So I mean, as a child, my mum and dad, you know, they did a lot of the organizing and my care and everything. And we did the sort of typical European holidays and a couple of other trips. Like we went to Disney World in America a couple of times. But my first independent trip was when I was at uni. I was about 22 years old and it was to Australia. So I did all of the organizing with the, you know, having two carers that were paid to come and do all my care support, all of the accessible rooms and all the other bits I'm sure we'll come on to talk about later. So Australia was one of my favorites. I've been back to the States a couple of times, to New York, and we did a road trip from San Francisco to Las Vegas down to Los Angeles. That was epic. And then I've stopped off at Singapore, been to Egypt, and then loads of places all over Europe many, many times.
Okay, wow. So you're quite the traveler.
I love travel, yeah.
Well, and also, when you're not traveling, you're quite busy. I was looking at your LinkedIn profile, and you have quite a bit on there. And so I'm probably going to get the order of things quite wrong, so you can correct me along the way. But sure. I just want to talk about some of your regular work activities. I'm sure which is your main time spender. But so you work for Scope, is that right? Can you explain what people's Scope is for outside the UK?
Yeah, so I worked for Scope 2006 to 2011. So that was my first job out of university. At uni, I studied economics and then a master's in marketing. And then I was kind of looking at jobs in London, kind of finance stuff, and was getting knocked back quite a lot. And I'll never know whether my disability was like a factor in that or not, who knows. But in the end, Scope had a job that was advertised in my hometown, and they're basically an NGO, like a charity, right, for disabled people. So in the end, it was a kind of safe step for me to get a job that was, you know, like bottom of the ladder, lower rung ladder, just to get started. And then I got a lot of learning and development through them. I ended up living and working for them in London. So it was really good kind of career development and getting more confidence about myself and my health and work-life balance and all those kind of things. So, yeah, it was a really good start to my career.
Okay. And then you've got two jobs that you have made along with Shrin, is that right? Sorry, Shrin or Shrin?
Yeah, Shrin.
Okay, yeah. And those are Accommable and Disability Horizons. Can you first tell us a little bit about Accommable? We'll probably get into them a bit later in the America story, but just a brief overview.
Yeah, Accommable was during mine and Shrin's travels. You know this, Josh, as well. You come up against the difficulty of finding accessible accommodation. Mm-hmm. So we decided to basically vet every accommodation that was on our website, and we kind of called it the Airbnb for disabled people, just because it was all, you know, the kind of tech startup, and that everyone was doing like this for Uber and Uber for this and all that kind of stuff. And then so over time, we got some grant funding, we got some investment, we built up quite a large number of properties worldwide, and also a community of disabled travelers. And then it was pretty much a year ago, actually, we managed to sell it to Airbnb. So the kind of accidental visualization became a reality.
I'll have to start putting names like that on myself as well.
Yeah.
It's okay. And then the other one is Disability Horizons. Can you tell us a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, so that all began before Accommable. And with that, it was basically, I started blogging about 2009. And then it was really my story of, you know, what I got up to as an individual with a disability, not just about travel, but all sorts of, about life, really, with a disability. And then we realized that a lot of other people wanted somewhere to have a voice, but they maybe didn't want their own website or to become a blogger, inverted commas. Right. So yeah, we decided that if we could create essentially a magazine, it would be a platform to give the disabled community a voice, but it's very much about lifestyle as well. We were very clear that it's not going to be all about campaigning or so political, and you know, that has to come into it because it's part of our life as disabled people. But we didn't want to go down too much the kind of angry activist route, but more the sort of can-do lifestyle approach.
Okay, so it's got a bit of everything on there then.
Yeah, I guess the broad themes are sex and relationships, employment, travel, leisure, technology. So they're the kind of more key areas.
Right, okay, so yeah, very full-fledged magazine.
Yeah.
Now, you also have your own personal site as well, and you also work for Open Inclusion. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the way I'd best describe really is that Horizons is more like a passion project that we are still looking at building up more and more with new projects and that it would have more and more funding. So we'd be able, because as a team of us, that we would give more of our time to it. But up to now, it's not so much of like a commercial venture or a job. It's something we do because we really love it. So I'm like a consultant, giving talks and doing social media and disability awareness training and that kind of stuff. And one of my clients is Open Inclusion. For them, so that they are a user insight kind of research consultancy, but specifically for disabled people. So they've got a big consumer panel, and then they can help brands with surveys or focus groups and things like that. And so, yeah, part of my paid work is supporting them with their mission.
Right. Okay. Well, so last question there, and then work line is how do you split your time between all of these different projects? Is it just a lot of coffee, or is it clones hidden away in your closet there? Or?
Well, with Horizons, as I say, we have a team. So there's like four of us that we have a content editor. So Liz is very much, owning all of the content and managing the writers. And we have Chris, who's our partnerships manager. So he's more building up the kind of advertising and sponsorship things that we've been doing more recently. And then I'm sort of just trying to look at the strategy and, keep all the different people I get introduced to, sort of bringing them into that world. I look to do sort of Monday to Friday, 8 hours a day. And then, whatever doesn't get done, it just rolls into the next week, basically.
Sounds good. Okay. Well, next thing I want to talk to you about is that you wrote a book, and the book title is Everything is Possible When You Believe. That's quite a decision to decide to write a book. And so I just wondered, what made you think, I want to write a book right now at this point in my life? What was your goal for the book?
Yeah, I think being a blogger and writing on my blogs, it was a natural progression that another step would be to put together a book. I considered putting sort of the most popular blog posts, as in sort of the ones with the most hits, mm-hmm. or my popular ones, as in my preferred ones that I just felt were good, and put it into like a compendium. But when I was looking through, it just would have been a bit too sort of jolted and wouldn't have flown properly, sort of flowed through properly. In the end, I decided that, if I was going to do a book, I should do it properly. And because it was going to take quite a while, and there were going to be costs as well with sort of design and editing and things like that, I actually crowdfunded on Kickstarter as well. So that was a way of trying to kind of offset the time that it was going to take and the costs that were going to be involved. So I can't recommend using the sort of Kickstarter type crowdfunding campaign for people that are looking to do that sort of stuff. In terms of goals, it really is a travel memoir. The first, as you know, I know you've read it, Josh. I'm interested to hear what you think in a moment. But the first chapter is autobiographical, to give people that insight into who I am and my past and what brought me here. But then the rest of the chapters really are about my travels. So I still feel I've got a couple more books in me on other topics, maybe. But yeah, it was just like, I love travel and I wanted to put all of those experiences in one place. And I suppose inspire disabled people of what is possible, and also show non-disabled people that as disabled people, we can do really cool stuff as well.
Okay. Since you're the creative one and I'm not very creative, I'm going to actually follow the chapter listings for what we're going to talk about next. So so people can get an idea of some of the content that's coming up in the book. First of all, so again, you talked about the bio bit, so your early experiences. You had one with a very scary mouse, I remember. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, as I said earlier, we went to Disney a couple of times. One when I was about 3, I think, or 4, and then another time when I was like 16. So when it was the first time, not the second time, then when I was very young, just to be clear on this. I couldn't get up the steps where the Mickey Mouse was dressed up, because obviously now we're aware how it works, but right. As a 4-year-old it was frigging Mickey Mouse, you know, I wanted to go and say hi to him and all that. And so I guess my mum or dad must have flagged his attention or her attention, whoever was in the seat, to come down and sort of say hi to me. But then at some point, as this big mouse descended down the steps to little 3-year-old me in my wheelchair, I suddenly got freaked out that it was a bad mouse and that it thought I was cheese and that it was going to eat me. And so I just cried and cried. And so the Mickey Mouse ended up running away as well.
Okay, so that wasn't when you were 16, just to clarify one more time.
Yeah, exactly. It was the younger age.
Okay, so you had a number of experiences with your family traveling, and then you went off to university in a separate town, that's right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, about sort of hour and a half away from home.
Right. And so you said in the book that was sort of quite a defining time in your life in terms of confidence, and can maybe elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, definitely there was two big moments for me that very much related to my disability. I don't know if I talk so much about the back operation. I'm sure I mentioned it in the book. And so that was a very medical procedure where I had rods, titanium rods put in my back, and I was like in hospital for a month, and it took like a year or two probably to recover properly. So that was a sort of sit there not feeling good but dream up the things I would want to do once I was well again. Right. And that definitely is part of, you know, defining moment for me. And then the other one, as you say, was going to university. Mum and dad had done all my care, and so to leave home, strangers essentially had to do my care. And for anyone listening that isn't as, you know, aware of what that entails, and obviously even people in a wheelchair have different needs, but right. For me, that does involve, you know, help in the shower and help going to the toilet. So it's a very intimate situation. Mm-hmm. I remember arriving at university, and, you know, my dad's being the kind of rock of the family, holding it all together, and I was obviously nervous. My mum was like crying as she was leaving the door, leaving her little boy, who was by that point 19, but obviously you're always the little boy to your mum. And so she was worried. And then the four carers that had been recruited by the university, they'd never done care either, because the way that it was set up was, it was sort of like a voluntary scheme. So people from all over the world wanted to come, not only to England, but in this instance, they'd wanted, this particular group of people wanted to come to England and learn the language and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, just see what England had to offer, but while doing something a bit more worthwhile and social, etc. So the carers were like my age, they were, you know, were sort of 19, 20. And they looked as scared as I was about what was going to happen. So you can imagine it was a really big step. And again, yourself, Josh, you have carers and everything, so you know the drill. That was a big step and a big thing to overcome. But obviously, it opened the world up to me, because I was no longer relying on my mum and dad to help me go to bed and, you know, come home early from a pub or a nightclub. So it really opened up the world to me as well.
Okay. And so then you got a lot of confidence through those experiences then, I assume.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And so that sort of led into your first solo trip that you mentioned earlier, and going to Australia. And it was that after you graduated then?
That was I'd graduated from my economics degree, and I was going to go back after the long summer to start my master's. So I was still at uni, but yeah, kind of in between.
Okay. So now you're in Europe, and there's lots of countries that are very nearby Europe. And Australia is very far from Europe. Is there any particular reason you chose to go as far away as you could?
Yeah, pretty much that was the reason. It was like, yeah, if I'm going to do this solo, inverted commas, solo trip with to care staff, then yeah, let's do this properly and do the hardest possible one. I say the hardest possible one, I mean, there's still places in the world that are less developed economically, mm-hmm. that are therefore less accessible and therefore more difficult. Right. So it wasn't difficult in the sense that the people spoke English, the culture was very similar, and there was pretty good access. But it was obviously difficult that it was the other side of the world.
Yeah. So how did you plan for this? It was your first time making the plans by yourself this time, right?
That's right, yeah. And I think for this one, I did go down to the town I'm in is near to Cambridge. So it's like a small town of 20,000 people. And I went down to the the travel agency, right. and spoke to the lady in there. And she was really, really cool as well. She really got what I needed. And that's always a worry, that you go to a non-specialist agency and they act and they say the right things, but when it comes down to it, they really haven't got a clue, right. the things that you need with a wheelchair, etc. But this woman really, really got it, and so that was very helpful that she was able to then reach out to her contacts in Australia to find, you know, the hoist I needed to hire, the adapted hire car vehicle, which hotels were, you know, with accessible roll-in shower rooms and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So she was helpful, but equally I still project managed it, and I had to save up the money, and I even managed to get the local government that fund the care to give some extra just for the trip, and they said that it was under like a respite pot of money, but they could see that, you know, this was a once in a lifetime opportunity for a sort of young student to go off for 3 weeks to Australia.
Well, you fooled them then, because it's not once in a lifetime, is it?
Well, yeah, that's the irony, right? But it was the only time they put some of the funding in for the carers. Well, more than what they normally put in for the carers anyway. But that was cool that, yeah, they got behind something like that as a sort of government local authority. That, I mean, this was 2005, I think, and yeah, we obviously, the crash that happened globally meant that, particularly in England, we've seen that, or not particularly, but I know from being in England that we've had a lot of cuts with funding. So I think it would be unlikely to happen where you get kind of extra for a holiday now, for your carers, obviously. But yeah, it was still cool that they got behind it and supported it.
Yeah, well, even if it wasn't a once-in-a-lifetime thing, I mean, it really highlights that taking a chance on somebody and helping them to achieve their dream can go on to help others by, you know, writing your book and your other experiences. So, you know, I think
100%
encouragement to all governments out there. So please make sure.
Yeah. Just take a moment to pause on that thought. Yeah. A message to all governments.
So, you explained in your book about all the places you went, but one thing that really caught me, I think, was a situation you had with your assistants when you were in Australia. You can start with a rough idea of what happened. And it's really something I think that gets brushed over when people talk about accessible travel. You know, people just think about, you know, very physical things like, you know, what's the hotel going to be like, or what's the access going to be like. But there are certainly human elements of travel. If you maybe sort of talk about that and what you learned from it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so basically the two carers that came with me, I knew them both. One from my school days, that she was when I was at school, they were called learning support assistants. Now in England, we call them teaching assistants. But essentially, it's like the carers that we need as adults, but just at school.
Right.
We did, PE and swimming, and we went on some school trips. So she supported me more than just in a classroom doing work. It was still the physical care that I need. And then the other guy was one of my carers at university. He'd very much been quite much more recent, had been around, and we still were hanging out a year or two after he'd moved on. But they hadn't met each other. So it was a bit of a, you know, I hadn't even thought about it before we went. And I think they met maybe briefly, but very briefly before we set off. They just didn't gel or click or basically get on. And when I wrote this chapter, actually, in the book, And even now, I'm sort of the two people involved. There was that whole wariness of their privacy because they know that they were there and they know who they are, but also others who know us sort of would know who they are too. Oh. So that it's not to say I can't talk about it,
right.
But it was just a kind of an interesting one. Whether I should put it in the book is more my point,
right.
That I really debated leaving it out for that reason, but I felt that the message was too strong to leave it, and the story was too strong to leave it. And so, yeah, it caused difficulties, you know, that they were having this sort of, they each felt that the other one wasn't doing enough of the work, of the care. And so, yeah, there was a night where it all came to a bit of a climax, and I actually met up with a friend of mine who I'd grown up with, who happened to be out in Australia, and we spent like a couple of days while he was there, and he pulled them aside and had a bit of a chat with them and said, you know, look, you're kind of ruining Martin's trip of a lifetime, or as we said, not in the end, it wasn't a trip. Yeah. And I think that maybe helped to smooth it over a bit. Right. But then the guy got really sick in Melbourne with like flu. Oh. And so that was then pretty difficult as well. And so, yeah, it's just the reality that carers quite clearly aren't yet robots. Yeah. And they have feelings, and, you know, they were a long way from home and they got tired and they got ill and were not as able to support me in the way I needed.
Yeah.
And also I was young and less able to do the kind of employment, you know, HR management type stuff that I've now learned more and more how to deal with as I've got older.
Right. Well, yeah, when you have a disability and you have carers and you sort of become the HR manager, don't you?
Yeah. Thrown in at the deep end, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a very important point. I think that everybody should read the book and read about that in more detail. Okay, we're going to move on to the other side of the world with another A. We're going to the Americas. And I guess the first one in the Americas, besides the mouse incident, you said you went a number of times with your father as well, but we went to Mexico and you weren't feeling very well. You had a bit of a health issues. You know, that's another very real part of travel. Can you sort of explain some of the health issues you had and how that worked out with your trip?
Yep. So as I mentioned at the very beginning with my disability, you know, I'm not necessarily more susceptible to colds. I think I get colds about the same amount that everyone does. Mm. But when I get a cold, I can't cough properly very well. So a normal common cold becomes a chest infection and it can become pneumonia. And it's like weeks of, you know, chest physio and antibiotics and all that kind of stuff. And that this was more the story when I was younger, for the last 5 years. And very much since I've been with my now fiance, Kasia, she kind of whipped me into shape with my diet and taking supplements. And I've actually, despite having colds, I've not had antibiotics for like 5 years now, which is pretty cool. Bit of a tangent to the story, but, you know, worth mentioning.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that in the story that you said that travel is better than antibiotics. So
Yeah. And so that was the thing, that I'd been very unwell prior to going to Mexico. So I was on antibiotics, coughing lots, etc. The downside was that we were all-inclusive. So not only was the food covered, but all of the booze and the alcohol was all included. And so even though I was feeling better with the actual cold, I wasn't really meant to drink because of the antibiotics. I think that the first point to make is that I felt really rotten. I still went, but the sun and the warmth and the whole being away and everything, I felt a lot better quite quickly. And then the positive with the alcohol story we just touched upon was that the volcano erupted in Iceland, meaning that we had to then stay on longer in Mexico by 3 or 4 days at least, and by which point I'd finished my antibiotics. We got like a 4-day extension to the holiday, all paid for, while we were waiting to be able to fly home when the volcano had or the ash had gone or whatever happened. So yeah, I was able to make the most of the all-inclusive booze and alcohol anyway.
And also you being in a wheelchair also paid off compared to some of your other companions, is that right?
That's right. So we were all in a very nice hotel. And then when the problem happened, those that were being, like, all basically apart from me, everyone that was being paid for to stay by the tour operator had to go to the other hotel down the road, which wasn't awful, but it wasn't as luxury as the one we'd been in. But yeah, because of the wheelchair room, I had to stay where we were. Oh, so that was definitely a plus.
Okay, then your next trip, you met up with somebody that comes into your life a lot, with Shrin, and you went to the States, and you went all over, or went to a number of places in the States, right?
Yeah, so I think the first trip was the road trip from San Francisco to Vegas to LA, where we met Jack Black at the airport. I don't know if you've ever seen the video on my about page on my blog.
Yeah, make sure you visit his blog.
Has actually done the video on my about page. It's awesome. So yeah, that was cool. But yeah, and then a year later, we went to New York with our other friend with SMA called Toby. Okay. So there was sort of over that couple of years, we did the West Coast and then a bit of the East Coast.
Okay. So and you're in that, you mentioned about the challenges of packing equipment, and that can be quite a challenge for people with disabilities as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's, for me, I obviously need to take the wheelchair.
Right.
And then sometimes when I'm away, I have rented or hired in equipment like a shower chair or a hoist. Mm-hmm. The trouble, particularly if like on a road trip, you're moving around. So you then have to get different companies to do it. And a big part of the price is the delivery cost as well. Right. So it becomes quite prohibitive having the rental solution. So the other option is to have a travel hoist and have your own shower chair and take it with you. Now, luckily, the airlines are very good about taking that kind of equipment with no extra charge. It's seen as like medical equipment or whatever. So right, that's good. But nonetheless, the particularly the hoist and the shower chair are rather large pieces of equipment that the carer has to essentially drag around from the airport and back to the hotel and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And then even beyond that, I have like a knee pad that goes between my knees when I sleep, so I don't get that sore between my knees. So that goes. I have the sling that is the sort of hammock thing that lifts me onto the hoist. Again, I'm just clarifying for anyone that doesn't know. And so yeah, that has to go in. And then there's all sorts of other, you know, bits and bobs that have to remember. Like, I used to take the spare antibiotics just in case. It was getting to the point where you're almost taking the kitchen sink with you. It's crazy.
But now, again, another plug for your book. There's a great scene in Las Vegas that includes a bar fight with one of the helpers. But they'll have to read the book to learn about that. But I think a couple of things that came up with your trip there with Shrin, and I guess probably was the catalyst for starting Accommable, was sometimes you had troubles at hotels where things weren't exactly as promised.
Yeah. So we got, I think it happened, San Francisco was all right from memory, but the Vegas and the LA hotels didn't have that. We booked wheelchair accessible rooms, one each for both of us, and we got there, and on arrival, that it wasn't suitable. Mm. So in Vegas, there was another one of those bittersweet moments, so where you'd arrived and you just want to go to your room and chill out and unpack, and then you have to have a discussion about sorting it out. But then the only suitable room they had was a VIP suite. So in the end, having not got the right kind of room, I had this massive room with the downside again was the hot tub wasn't accessible. Proper kind of bling, you know, VIP room. So that sort of offset itself in the end.
But a good experience again, and you know, not always trusting what you've been told, but being prepared to work through things when you get there. So I guess that's an important skill to have as well.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously, it doesn't always end up with a VIP big, large suite. That's very, very, very unusual. And yeah, and in LA, the result was that we just couldn't shower. Right. And we were there 3 or 4 days, so it wasn't crazy long, but still, you know, normally within 3 or 4 days, you'd want a couple of showers.
Of course,
and so absolutely, that really should not happen, and that is wrong. But there's definitely a lesson about almost being very, with the research, really just double, triple checking things. So ever since that, I tend, once I've used something like, a Commonwealth's obviously been swallowed by Airbnb.
Right.
But whether it's Airbnb or hotels.com, whatever it might be, is to really reach out to the owner and triple check, because it just has gone wrong too many times now.
Well, and there's also such a, you know, variety of people with disabilities that, you know, what's accessible for one person is not necessarily accessible for someone else. So, you know, whoever's making that, this is accessible, they might not know, you know, and that might just be different than your needs, right? So it's really important to get in touch with them. Okay, so we're going to take it back a little bit closer to your home then, and to your European adventures. The one that really, I guess, actually all of them. You have too many exciting stories. the thing with EVS, and you went and lived in a different country for a while. Can you explain what EVS is? I hadn't heard about this before. So,
sure. Well, obviously, politically at the moment with Brexit, it's a European Union-funded project, so who knows what's going to happen in the future.
Right.
But EVS stands for European Voluntary Service. And the story starts where I was still at Scope, or just about to leave Scope. I'd got some ideas of what I would do to earn money to live off and survive and basically not end up under a bridge after leaving the job at Scope. But a big part of leaving was wanting to travel more. And so without an abundance of money to just be like, oh, I'm going to go road trip around Europe now, you know, I subletted my place on Airbnb once this project came through.
Right.
So my London flat, it was a great way of saving money by not having to pay for that while I was away. But I basically started looking for ways to go abroad, but with funding. And so the EVS scheme is where it was like 18 to 30 year olds, but not 18, 30 holidays in the kind of raunchy, debauched way. And you do a bit, in fact, some of the carers that helped me at uni were via this same scheme.
Oh, okay.
So then I then was looking for projects in Spain, and my plan was like, oh yeah, I'm going to go away in the winter and Spain's warmer, and you know, I'll be able to get some good, healthy, warm sunshine. And so most of the projects in Spain were not suitable and not wheelchair accessible. Right. Either the project was like picking things in a field, which I'm just not going to be able to do. That's an example. But basically the projects weren't suitable, or the project was, but then the accommodation that they had for the volunteers wasn't suitable, until one came up in the northwest of Spain. And it turned out the lady who was my like coordinator, my manager, her brother was disabled. So she was really like, you know, linked in and understood what was needed. And she was phenomenal. I mean, she made sure that everything I needed went into the budget that then went to the European Commission. And so the deal is that they fund your flights there and back for the, you know, to get there and to come home after the project. They fund your accommodation. They fund like a food and drink sort of allowance. So you're not earning a wage, but you've got kind of like pocket money in a way. And so I taught English to the local teenage kids that were part of this local sort of social club, really. It was a council run, a sort of local government run initiative. I taught them English, and I did employment workshops, like CV workshops as well. and I had my own radio show, which is really fun. Cool. Yeah. So it was an amazing experience to actually be doing this social good project,
right,
but also to be learning Spanish and just to live in another country with a different culture as well.
Mm. And so how long were you there for?
So the first time was around 2 months.
Okay.
And then the second time, I loved it so much, I wanted to go back a year later. And I went for a bit more than 3 months the second time.
So was it kind of different to be, you know, sometimes we go on vacations for a couple of weeks versus actually being there for a couple of months? Did you find that quite a bit different?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I say I lived there. I don't know when the definition of living somewhere kicks in.
Right.
But for me, as you've just said, it was more than a two-week holiday. And I remember after about a month there, not really knowing the language well enough to really sort of, you know, be part of that culture and the conversations. Obviously, a lot of people spoke English, so I wasn't totally isolated. Right. But essentially, it was a very different world from being home. And, you know, not being as close to friends and family, just to pop round for a cup of tea. Obviously, you know, being right. English, cups of tea are very important. So, yeah, it really was. And I remember feeling quite homesick a couple of times. And I was 27, 28 at the time. Right. So I wasn't, like, just a teenager or a lot younger. You know, I was an adult, but I still remember feeling quite homesick as well.
Hmm. Now, we're going to skip over the next one where you are involved with going around on a road trip around Europe. And people will have to read that in the book.
Okay.
But I think that the interesting one is the Europe Without Borders work. I think that's sort of interesting how your experiences from touring on your own sort of built up a portfolio for you to turn it, you know, into a job, for a temporary job anyways. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Is that the one where we did the five countries around Europe? Is that the one?
Yeah, that one.
I mean, I did a road trip, which I think might have been the one that you just sort of briefly skipped over, where I crowdfunded it and I went with one carer. So that was all self done. And then the Europe Without Barriers was, again, a European Commission project where a charity in Italy had raised the funds to do the project. And it was very much highlighting the good of the places that we went to.
Right.
So, you know, I think there are times where I go somewhere to help with making the environment more accessible, or to train staff, or to look at the policies and, you know, the overall kind of organizational structure. And that's more about what's bad and how to make it good. When other times I get invited where they've done that and they're proud of it,
right,
and they want to get the message out. So really that was, you could say, like a marketing initiative on their part to showcase and celebrate these five countries that were particular things were possible that were good. So we went to Italy, Slovenia, Croatia, Austria and Germany in like 12 days or something ridiculous. Wow. Yeah. And they had a minibus with a driver, but we'd got the boat and lived, I say lived, we were in Barcelona for like a month.
Okay.
So we had our car, we as my fiance and I.
Right.
So that meant that we had to do the driving on the trip and benefit from the minibus and all that stuff.
Right.
So really full on trip. But yeah, the places that we saw were phenomenal, really beautiful.
Okay. And so then that sort of leads to the next one where, again, because of your very particular set of skills, you were invited to come to my neck of the woods, and you came to Japan back in 2014. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And you were invited by the government, and you had a bit of a panic at the airport when you met the other people, as I remember correctly from the book, in terms of clothing.
With the what, sorry?
Clothing.
Yeah, oh God, the suit incident, you mean? Yes. Yeah, I mean, it was, I think if I wasn't disabled, I would definitely be far more hippie, nomadic kind of, and I sort of am quite hippie nomadic, but because of my disability, I have to be really on it with planning and research and, you know, obviously we said like managing carers and all that kind of stuff. You have to be really on the ball. So, but there is still that side of me where I don't kind of maybe give it the full attention and, you know, just kind of we were getting ready and we were packing and made sure I got all the disability stuff. But I don't really wear suits at all. I mean, I think I have got kind of one that I could pull out for weddings and funerals, but it's not very comfortable and I just don't really wear them much. And I just didn't think about it in Japan. And then, yeah, we got there and there was the element about the ceremonies and the formalities and that we're going to be at least 1 or 2 days of the project where it was proper suit attire, which I hadn't packed. So I basically made do with, I had a smart pair of trousers, a white shirt, and a dark jumper. And I pretty much ended up wearing that the whole time in Japan.
So definitely, yeah, different culture and different expectations and stuff. And so the purpose of the event was to sort of collaborate with the government about different schemes in different countries. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I think the main initiative of the Japanese government was looking at their policies for older people, younger people, and disabled people. And by bringing other young leaders, it was called a young leaders program from New Zealand, Denmark, and the UK, then there was a general benefit of knowledge and experience sharing, but it was very much funded by the Japanese government so that they could take away the benefits to implement the ideal sort of outcomes that were found for their own policy. So it was really cool to be involved at that level of, you know, helping make or shape policy in a whole country. And it was very interesting. There were differences between New Zealand, Denmark, and the UK with some of the healthcare, social care, inclusion to public life. But I mean, Japan, how long is it? Have you been living out there now?
11 years now, yeah.
11 years. So you were there when I was there, right?
Yeah. We probably bumped into each other on the street and gave each other stink eye about who this other guy in the wheelchair is that's sort of stealing my limelight, you know.
This town ain't big enough for the both of us. It would have been there at the same time. But yeah, you'll know that there are quite striking differences with how Japan is, particularly with disability. I mean, I don't know your views, but I found they were phenomenal with like getting on the metro. There was this guy with gloves that picks the ramp up and bows to you. It was like really like, wow, this is full on customer service. But I kind of felt that there was maybe a little bit more, shame feels quite a strong word, but that the view around disability was not as open and liberal as it might be in Europe or the States. I don't know what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, there's sort of definitely different aspects are very good, and you know, there's definitely good and bad. You know, for example, the service and getting on the train, the infrastructure is very good. But I was talking with a friend actually who has a disability, is from Spain, and he was mentioning that, you know, he can get around by himself, but he uses a wheelchair, and it just sort of doesn't seem to compute in Japan that somebody in a wheelchair can go by themselves. And a lot of times, you know, people who are go very much by the book, you know, like they get a bit nervous when there's somebody who isn't with a helper or attendant, and then they're like, well, what if something happens? And sorry, you can only do that if you're with your attendant, you know. Just, you know, the idea, different ideas of what, you know, living with a disability means. So so there's definitely ups and downs and good and bad stuff,
we went to see a couple of the people that were there more around disability. We then went to Hiroshima as well. And we then got to see various schools and care homes and sheltered workplaces. And I generally shudder when I see disabled people that are not included in society. But actually, it goes on in England still. So it wasn't a Japanese thing.
Right.
You know, I think that there are parts of every country where there is still an element of that being away from the mainstream.
Yeah,
And that's some of the work we still have left to do, I suppose.
For sure. We got lots of, you have to come back again, I guess. And again, okay, we're just going to go into some more teasers for everybody to get your book. And some of the things you've done besides traveling to other countries, or I guess they have involved traveling to other countries, but adventure moments, for example, hot air ballooning and piloting an airplane, as well as, abseiling? Is that how you say it?
Abseiling, yeah.
Abseiling, okay. And I wasn't quite sure what that was, but I looked up some pictures and I saw Martin tied to some ropes being hauled up into the woods. So you'll have to read about that in his book. So, Martin, how can people get your book?
Sure. So it's on Amazon. Okay. And Audible. I sat there for a day doing the recording of the audio version as well. On Amazon or Audible.
Okay. And we're just going to sort of go into a closing lightning round. And I'm going to ask your top three places on your personal bucket list of places you'd like to visit.
Okay. So at the moment, Hawaii's definitely there. Okay. I'd love to see Hawaii. India's been on the list for quite a while. As we referred to earlier, there's that element of more involved in making sure that it's, I know it's doable now, but yeah, it's obviously a bit more involved to make sure it works well. So that's one. And what's the other one I was thinking of? There was something the other day that I was pondering. But yeah, I think Hawaii, India, and Dubai is somewhere that I'd like to see as well.
Okay. So those are good goals. Okay, and you mentioned your book a lot of times, actually. I was like, oh, wow, you really like your music. So we have a playlist on Spotify for people who have showed up on the podcast. So can you maybe list three songs that you like to listen to when you're traveling or just when you're thinking about going traveling?
Yeah, one is definitely Jack Johnson. So it's more of an artist, I suppose, but Better Together if I was pushed for one song.
Right.
But yeah, definitely anything by Jack Johnson. Kings of Leon.
Yeah.
Lose Somebody. And Nelly, Ride With Me.
Okay, well, that's a good list. Okay, great. So just in closing then, how can people get in touch with you? How can they follow you? You're, you're hard to miss on the internet, but just to sum up some of the ways they can follow you.
Yeah, well, I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, and Instagram, so people can get hold of me there. Just my name, Martin with a Y, and then Sibley, S-I-B-L-E-Y. My blog is martinsibley.com, and those that are more interested in disability and accessible travel as well, then Disability Horizons is a great place for sort of sharing knowledge and experiences.
All right, sounds good. We'll put links to all those places as well in the show notes and on the website. So thank you very much, sir. And you have a lovely day and we'll be in touch, I'm sure.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Josh.
All right, thank you. I really enjoyed that conversation and I hope that you did too. I encourage you to check out Martin's website, martinsibley.com, and find him on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as well. And you can pick up his book, Everything is Possible, on Amazon. You can also find Martin on the Accessible Travel Forum. And you too can join the Accessible Travel Forum, www.accessibletravelforum.com. The more users we have, the more useful the site will become. Be sure to ask questions and share your knowledge. You can also follow us on Twitter with the handle AccessibleTF. That's at AccessibleTF. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with friends. Also, be sure to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Is there somebody that you think we should be interviewing? Do you want to be interviewed? If so, then please contact us at podcast@accessibletravelforum.com. That's podcast@accessibletravelforum.com. Keep enjoying your travels. Hopefully we'll bump into each other along the way. Until next time, I'm Josh, and this is Have Disability, We'll Travel.